Podcast deferred. That's still the worst way to open any podcast ever. I think the most awkward part of doing any podcast is the opening, to be honest. I never know.
And also the ending.
Ending's easy because you just kind of cut it off at the end.
Yeah, you just do a Charlie Brooker, say, right, go away.
Yes. So we're back for another painful potsplosion, which is still a terrible name, but you got to have it. It's like the law, you've got a terrible name for your podcast.
Really? That's the law?
Well, I didn't know what else to call it, really.
Yeah, good point.
It's kind of a painful podcast, maybe-ish. A little bit vain. I want to put my name in it.
Yeah. That's on your website.
Yeah, there's that too. So, you're Sam.
Yes, I'm still Sam, and you're still Sean, I think.
Sean this week is brought to you by Stella Artois 4%. The triple filtered smooth lager.
Other lagers are available.
Other lagers are available. But, interestingly, parts of the country call England call this wife beaters.
Oh, yeah.
I've always assumed that that was some sort of clever reference to Marlon Brando as well, the streetcar named Desire.
Yeah.
Where he was wearing a wife beater.
Yeah.
Vest. You know, Stella! Yeah. But, to be honest, it's more likely the fact that just that you get a lot of people who beat their wives drink Stella.
Maybe.
It seems too clever a reference for that to be the actual reasoning behind it.
Yeah, it does a bit.
It being called, well, nicknamed wife beater, you know. But it's a gloriously warm Sunday afternoon. Well, it's just turned afternoon, isn't it?
So, yeah, I think so.
The quietest room of the house may have various noises from outside because we know where how we shut the window.
The quietest room in the house is also the hottest.
Hottest room of the house. And the birds are chirping and stuff. And it's not their quiet period, so.
Yeah.
So, how's that for an introduction? There you go.
Yeah, that's an introduction.
Let's see if I get slowly drunk as this progresses, since I'm basically topping up from yesterday.
Okay.
We have another agenda.
Yay.
Oh, yeah, we can't say what the video is yet, because I haven't recorded it.
No.
It may be never.
Well, we were considering doing it from my perspective this week, so we'll see what's going to happen.
So, surprise, we don't know what's actually being on screen for the YouTube version of this right now.
Yeah. So this is all very well planned, as you can see.
I think we should just dive straight into the games this week, because there's not really any topical stuff.
Yep.
I'm not going to talk about football again.
No.
So, last time, 2 weeks ago, I was playing Grand Theft Auto V, collecting all the stuff.
Yes.
And I thought, well, I'll have a break from that. Yes. So I bought Murdered Soul Suspect, which turns out to be a game entirely about collecting stuff.
Yes.
So I've pretty much moved from one scavenger hunt to another scavenger hunt.
Scavenger hunt, the game!
It really is. They should just call it Murdered Scavenger Hunt Suspect or something.
Yes.
The plot is you're a detective who gets killed while investigating this serial killer. And he becomes a ghost and tries to use his new ghostly abilities to solve his own murder, basically.
Mm.
And solve the various murders this serial killer's done.
Yeah.
I'm a bit torn on it, really. I feel a bit cheated. Game cost me £50, and I don't think it was £50 worth of game, to be honest.
No.
It feels very much like the kind of... It's the bit in Batman where you're doing all the collecting bits, where you're solving all the Riddler puzzles.
Yeah.
It's pretty much that bit.
Yeah.
Without all the other stuff.
And with less trophies.
Well, there's plenty of trophies.
No, I mean like the little Riddler trophies.
Oh, the Riddler trophies, yeah, okay, the little collectibles.
Yeah. Do a thing, get a green little blip.
I don't know, it's just a weird game. It feels like it's the kind of thing that should have been released for about 20 quid or something. It's a budget title.
Mm.
It doesn't use the PS4's full capabilities. It looks nice, but it's not graphically impressive in any way.
No.
There's not really anything in it that's taxing the system. I think this is one of those games where the PS4's is loading it and cruising along sort of thing.
Mm.
I can't help but feel that the entire dynamic was actually a glitch that they thought they'd include. So he no-clipped through a wall, the main character, at some point. And they said, hey, there's an interesting dynamic. You can have a character that walks through walls. Let's make him a ghost. But, annoyingly, you can only walk through certain walls.
Yeah.
Because they've said that it's set in Salem, you know, the infamous place where...
So everywhere is...
Consecrated buildings, so everything's been blessed. So ghosts cannot come and go freely. They have to wait for doors or windows to be open before they can pass into buildings. But it just feels a bit cheap. Because you've got this big open like town area to explore. And I want to go walking through buildings. I want to see...
Yeah, you want to see people eating their dinner.
I want to see people living their daily routine. And it kind of annoys me because a lot of the characters are just very, very bland. The NPCs, they've got about five different character models.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a prude. Bioshock had 8 character models, but then that's an entirely different game. You're not trying to interest people in the town or the thing in that game. Well, you are, but there's a lot of...
Yeah. It depends which Bioshock, because obviously Infinite, at the beginning, you want people to be going, oh my god, this is amazing, I want to explore everything.
Infinite
but again,
had a lot more character models.
Yeah, but in the original Bioshock, though, everyone was murdered or crazy, so you were going to have a lot less people
you
about.
You weren't supposed to associate with those people. They were strictly psychopaths that had to kill you.
Yeah. Whereas in the opening scenes of Bioshock Infinite, people don't realise that they want to kill you yet, so you're kind of just mingling.
I mean, I feel they could have... Nobody's ever played Deadly Premonition, because it's notoriously kind of one of those Marmite games where it's... From the position that it's a PS3 game, it's terrible. The graphics are awful, dialogue's stilted, the gameplay's repetitive. And yet, it's probably one of my all-time favourite games because it's just so charming. You really do fall in love with the town because you're an FBI guy going around the town. Everyone's got a routine. You can actually pretty much stalk everyone around the town and learn their daily routine and their lives, and they all have something to talk about. And you actually start caring about these people. You know, this is what they should have done with Salem, is they should have kind of created an entire town which had depth to it.
Yeah.
So like, oh, there's Mrs. Wilkins, you know, who has a son and stuff, and you know, you can follow them through the house and the rest of it. Because Salem's not a massive place.
No.
You can explore town in about 10 minutes.
No.
This feels like a missed opportunity. Also, very white.
Yeah.
It just dawned on me the other day randomly as I was getting up in the middle of the night sort of thing, just clicked, like, oh, that's why it feels a bit odd, is that there's all white people in this town.
Yeah. Because you also kind of explained to me that you think the game feels half-finished in places, like, there's all those traps in the floor that, like, they could be demon spawners, but then nothing actually happens. And...
Yeah, because there's, like, there's two elements to the game, so you're either... You're walking around collecting stuff. Even the investigation stuff with the puzzles is pretty much walk around the area and then look at interesting things. So, oh, look, there's some pencils on the floor. That's a clue. Or, oh, there's a scroll on the wall. That's a clue. There's a note here. That's a clue. You're just collecting stuff over and over. But then in between, you get these segments where these demons appear and you have to sneak up behind them to kind of exorcise them. Exorcise. Rather than exercise. You don't have a stand and stare lift and start doing, you know, crunches, whatever.
Yeah.
You don't crunch on a stand and stare lift.
No, but...
This shows how much I go to the gym.
Yes.
But, yeah, there's these odd sneaking segments, and there's these essences that are just floating around which you can hide inside, and the demons can't see you inside them. But these essences are everywhere. But there's not enough demons to justify the essences, so it feels like there should have been areas where demons were there, or some sort of deeper gameplay mechanic.
Yeah.
It just feels a very empty game.
Yeah.
It's not a bad game. No. I recommend it for a cheaper price.
Yeah.
I am kind of enjoying it to a certain extent, but and even the collectibles, like, I mean, there's a lot of kind of text behind it. Everything you pick up's got a bit of descriptive text.
Yeah.
Annoyingly, you have to click the menu button, so you open a new menu to get description up. But it's all out depth, but I just don't have time to sit down and read all these description texts. And most of them are quite boring anyway.
Yeah, although some of the things that's like you're collecting a certain number and then it tells you a creepypasta story.
Yeah, that's the main sideline quest, is that there's these... Because there's main buildings, so there's like every chapter's a new building. So there's an insane asylum, there's a graveyard, a hotel. And every single one's got like a specific set of items you have to find. They're like hidden items, and then you have to reveal them and then collect them. And then you collect a certain number and it gives you a creepypasta story. And it's legitimately just like a static bit of art with some bloke doing a voiceover or a woman doing a voiceover telling the story sort of thing. And it's not even particularly good creepypasta. It's like subpar kind of, and he died 10 years ago. Yeah. Or the one that I've just found recently is like the man in the box. Oh, Oh dear, the bird's a bit upset.
Yeah.
Cut it out, you two. Come on. Try to tell a story here, goddamn. Anyway, there's this man in a box, and it's, it turns out this doctor's had this bloke chained up inside this hidden cell or something. And it's pretty much that bit from Seven, where there's Sloth, where the guy's kind of like lying in bed, and he's kept on intravenous this thing, and dies like after he's been moved, sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's just terrible, creepy person.
Yeah.
And it's something to do, I suppose, but it doesn't particularly lend anything to the game.
No. I think they thought it was like building the lore of the town, where it's actually just random creepypasta.
It really is. Doesn't provide anything. I mean, if it was a case of, in some of them, it's like you still hear the wailing of the little girl from inside the place, but then you can actually go to that place in the game, and there's no one there. You know, you expect to see like ghosts of these people.
Yeah.
So, oh no, just missed opportunity. It just feels a bit. Maybe it was overhyped.
Yeah, I think
it was kind of billed as a AAA game.
Yeah,
and it's not. It should have been billed as a quaint little thing that's been put together. It's like a mess around game.
Yeah,
I'm enjoying it, and I'll finish it. But it's quite short as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm about two-thirds of the way through.
Yeah.
Another game entirely different. Oh no, that's what they could have done. Sorry, I was about to say they could have done like a Beetlejuice thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's got overtones of Beetlejuice, the whole ghost thing.
Yeah.
They could have had a sense of humour with it, maybe. They played a bit too straight.
Mm.
Oh, no, it's just kind of middle of the road. It's like it doesn't really want to do anything too unique.
Mm. Doesn't want to overexert itself.
I mean, even the main character's basically doing a bad Harrison Ford impression.
Mm.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's that.
But the other mystery game I've been playing this week is Sherlock Holmes vs. Jack the Ripper, which I'm actually enjoying far more.
Yeah.
Even though the graphics are worse and the dialogue's even worse.
Sherlock Holmes always sounds like he's
stuffed up
and just has a lisp or something, because he's just there stuttering through all his sentences.
I think that game's only got about three voice actors in it, because I'm pretty sure I've heard Sherlock's and Watson's voice actors.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have as well.
In various, trying to do different voices. I get the feeling that Jack the Ripper was a game they did in between the other games they produced, because they're just churning these things out. But the Testament of Sherlock Holmes, which was released on PS3, absolutely fantastic game. Like, the graphics were brilliant. The puzzles actually made me want to play it, even though they were so difficult that I had to ask for help from some people.
Yeah.
You know? And this one, you know, I think they found their groove with that one.
Mm.
But this is the one before that. It's only got the one location, which is Whitechapel. Okay, you expect that, because it's Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it gets a bit boring walking back and forth along the same street all the time.
Yeah.
So it does feel a bit like, okay, we can get this one knocked out pretty quickly. Because it's only going to have so many characters in it.
Yeah.
Inspector Abelone turns up.
Oh, yeah.
He was actually historically the inspector on it, wasn't he, I guess?
I think he might have been.
Either that, or he was just in From Hell. Because he was Johnny Depp's character, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I was kind of hoping they were going to make Inspector Abelone more like Johnny Depp. Maybe do something like that, but they've just gone for a generic kind of British...
Yeah, I don't think they tend to go for actually trying to mimic popular culture. They just kind of get the characters
and
throw them out
there. But in one of the previous ones, there was an explicit reference to Bruce Wayne and Batman. Because there's a bat symbol. And then one of the policemen was like, oh, go fetch Officer Wayne, this is right up his alley sort of thing.
Okay. I forgot about that.
There are various nods to bits and pieces of pop culture sometimes.
Yeah, but they don't do anything explicit, like getting a character that actually, like a proper plot character actually act like someone who appeared in another movie or something.
I suppose, yeah.
And Sherlock's sort of slowly developing certain... other Sherlockisms from other series.
He's not going to do the slow motion thing.
Or even whatever common patches
this
was.
Register on an emotional level.
Oh, wow.
Quickly, click on the puzzle. Walk slowly down corridor. At least Watson's... In one of the previous games, Watson had a really creepy ability to just kind of teleport in front of you.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Like, if you turn
around,
that
was in the Lupin one, because obviously Watson would just kind of follow you around as you explore various places to find clues and stuff. So there'll be times where he'd be right behind you. You go into the next room, he's there waiting for you.
There's a video online someone's done where they put creepy music to it. So you're walking around in first person, and everywhere you turn, there's just Watson kind of appearing, like the Slender Man. It's creepy as hell. And I remember there's later on in the same game, they do the same thing with a dog.
Yeah.
It used to creep the hell out of me because you walk from one room into another, and the dog's there. It's like, how the hell have you done that?
How many dogs do they own here?
Oh, dear. But I quite like the Jack the Ripper angle. I was expecting it to be a darker game. I was expecting to see a lot more gore.
Yeah.
They've done Jack the Ripper tastefully.
Yeah.
In that rather than showing you pictures of corpses, they've actually kind of got cartoon versions.
Yeah.
Which is a bit weird.
Yeah, it was a bit weird because obviously you're there examining one body, all her hands and stuff.
Well,
inspecting under the fingernails and things, yeah, they're all rendered. Then you go in the face where it's been all battered and bruised and stuff. It's just a cartoon.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like an artist's impression, I guess.
Yeah.
Rather than show you the actual face, which would have been mutilated.
Yeah.
But and yet, I know in other Sherlock games, they've clearly shown like bodies that have been torn to pieces and stuff.
Yeah, like that was in the Cthulhu one, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that was one in the Cthulhu game, and then after that, when the Testament of Sherlock Holmes, they had a scene where there's the guy who's been torn to pieces by his own dog.
Oh, yeah, right.
So that must have been there. They're like, okay, we can't get away with just doing
cartoons.
We better just show it. Mm. But I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
I don't know who they're going to say did it, or whether Sherlock would indeed solve the case.
Mm.
I'm not sure what they could do with that, really. I think they made a couple of references to various theories. Like, wasn't it Patricia Cornwell who did the whole... I've discovered Jack the Ripper, and she said it was some painter from America or something.
Yeah, I think there was, like, the painter from America, then there was, some, Toff's son or something, a count's son or something. Like, some guy in high society, and then, obviously, there's other theories, but it was just, a doctor working in the local hospital who went a bit nuts.
Yeah, I mean, there is a local doctor. He's a bit too friendly.
Yeah.
I don't know, he seems too friendly in terms of, this could be all a front here.
Yeah, well, one of the prevailing things was that it was a doctor because obviously one of the murders, one of the proper murders, obviously, when the Ripper was trying to get away, he just kind of goes up to the back of the hospital, washes his hands, just walks through the hospital as though he belongs. And
I remember the history teacher telling that story too. That was amazing.
Yeah. Well, we were in the same class there.
But that was really interesting. But they'd done that with Sherlock Holmes, so I've just done a bit where Watson's visited the Royal College of Medicine, and they've said, oh yes, we've had some cadavers go missing.
Hmm.
Like some female cadavers, so I'm not sure if they're going to go down the whole doctor route. I guess they will.
Yeah. It sounds like someone either trying to become a doctor by studying really fresh specimens, or if it's just an actual doctor gone crazy.
They touched on this Lever Apron character. I vaguely remember hearing about him in history.
Yeah.
But there was some guy who apparently did have that nickname.
Hmm.
It was a bit mental.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it. We'll have to see how it turns out.
Yeah.
And then I've got all the others to go through because I bought every single Sherlock Holmes game in Humble Bundle.
Sherlock Holmes games tend to be quite fun to play. A bit frustrating in places, but we've always enjoyed them.
Yeah, I think they get better and better because...
Yeah.
When they started out making them, some of the puzzles were just damn obscure. Okay, here's a recipe for dog treats.
Oh, yeah.
Only half of it's missing. And most
you must feed the real, the royal dog, but don't you dare give it the crap left on the floor.
That's it. And also, it was like half the measurements are in Imperial. I never learned Imperial, so I don't know Imperial.
No.
And then half the measurements are missing as well, and it's like times two of the previous measurement or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Those puzzles are ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the games they've actually remastered. I'm using finger quotes here, where they put a little hint thing in the corner.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's over to the universalhintsystem.com, which is a brilliant website, which is better than GameFAQs because it doesn't give you immediate answers; it just gives you hints.
Yeah.
So rather than saying, "Oh, you need to go down the road and talk to Mrs. Smith about the laundry,"
It's really cryptic thing saying, you know, Mrs. Smith seemed to have something to say.
Or do you know, have you visited a lady called Mrs. Smith yet? And then it'll ask you a question like, where is Mrs. Smith? And you click on that.
It's like, each hint has multiple layers. So it starts off with, maybe you should see someone else in the town. Maybe you should go further down this one street. Mrs. Smith was interesting. God damn it, talk to Mrs. Smith!
Yeah, so pretty much it gets more and more up to the point where it just tells you.
Yeah.
But you must be consistent for the win.
Yeah.
Not much else to add, which I've got really, is
there? No, not really.
Okay, we'll switch track on to something else entirely. I want to talk about this on the agenda.
Yeah.
So one thing I've tried to do several times now is read Goldfinger, the book. Because I love the film. I always try to get into the books. And having listened to the audiobook within the past 2 weeks, I can tell you never to read, well, not never to read Ian Fleming, but never read Goldfinger, because you remember how the film starts.
Yeah.
So it starts with a card game next to a pool, and then it switches to a golf game, and then there's a lot of walking around and talking. But what they managed to do with the film, miraculously, is condense down, it's quite faithful to the book, the film, but it's an hour and a half long, whereas the book's 8 hours long, and you get every single bloody minute of that golf game. Mm-hmm. And there's something, and a card game, you know, you get to hear every single bit of it, and there's nothing worse than just reading page after page, or listening to page after page of golf.
Yeah.
I don't know, I quite like the book. It's one of those rare occasions where the film was a lot better than the book. And you're going to be like, okay.
Yeah.
Because you didn't like the film, did you?
No, but then again, I find it hard to get really interested in spy thrillers, because half the time they just descend into either shootouts or car chases, or it's just in Bond's case, there's always, you know, the scene where he just has to randomly screw just some woman who doesn't really have much to do with the plot or whatever.
I mean, there was one point I thought you might find interesting, in that in the book, Pussy Galore's not the head of a flying circus. She's actually the head of, like, a female group of cat burglars.
Oh, yeah.
So they're all just trained cat burglars.
Okay.
But they don't actually have a role to serve in the book, apart from being more mobsters to help out with the big gold heist at the end.
Okay.
The film actually gives them more purpose, because they're there to spray the sarin gas over Fort Knox. Which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
And in the book, it's implied that Pussy Galore isn't lesbian, she's actually bisexual.
Okay.
So Bond didn't convert her.
Okay.
It was more a case that she just had interests.
Yeah. Okay.
Interestingly, one of the ladies he meets earlier in the book is actually a lesbian.
Uh-huh.
And she falls in love with Pussy Galore.
Ah, right.
In a kind of creepy, stalkerish way.
Okay, that's not quite... Okay. Still different.
Well, no, but basically he gets to the point where, because Goldfinger's probably one of the only stories where Bond spends the entire thing captured.
Yeah.
And during that bit, is it Tilly or Jilly? Because there's Tilly Masters at the beginning, and then there's her sister appears.
Yeah.
And it's her sister who's the lesbian, because then she starts having these kind of, oh, it's alright, Pussy Galore will protect me.
Okay.
And so she goes a bit Stockholm syndrome-ish, sort of.
Yeah.
But that's why she's not interested in Bond at all.
Yeah.
But little things like that, and then there's, notoriously, the film actually fixed one major plot hole. In that, even though Goldfinger's got a train and a whole bunch of cars and 100 gangsters to help him with the heist, there's no way he'd be able to shift all that bullion in, I think he's given himself 3 days.
Mm.
I think the film says it would take 12 days at least.
Yeah.
And they point that out, which is why in the film they actually came up with the idea of him irradiating the gold.
Yeah.
In order to make his own gold stock soar in value.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite clever.
Yeah, it's quite clever.
It's actually genuinely one of those things where the film has just kind of condensed everything about the book into something watchable.
Yeah.
Or something enjoyable. I mean, there's an extended scene where Bond visits Goldfinger's mansion. which is completely superfluous. It's there pretty much just so that Bond can have a poke around his estate and see if there's anything going on, sort of thing. I don't know. I mean, would I recommend it? Probably not.
No.
There are other Bond books out there which are a bit more kind of interesting. Dr. No actually was one of them because the film was so kind of so early in the process. It was 1960-something, 1962, I want to say. That might be from Rush of Love, actually. Where they couldn't really bring it to justice, sort of thing. Bring it to the screen properly.
Yeah.
Because Dr. No was actually more of an interesting character because he was a bald guy who had himself elongated.
Yeah.
He wore contact lenses, but they were coloured so that you could scare people with dummy stuff. And he was killed by 6 tons of bird shit landing on top of his head.
Wow, what a way to go.
Yeah. Because originally Crab Key and Dr. No was a guano processing plant, which was his front.
Okay.
Which didn't get touched at all in the film.
No.
He just dies by radiation because he's got metal hands, he can't climb out.
Yeah.
I personally prefer the bird shit there myself.
Yeah. Sounds slightly more interesting.
He was such an obnoxious character as well. I mean, the BBC Radio 4 had a adaptation of Dr. No.
Yeah.
Where David Suchet, Poirot himself, was Dr. No, but you wouldn't have recognised it because he put on this horrible kind of voice that was like, "Yes, my name is Dr. Julius No," and it was like really kind of, the deflection was all wrong, it's horrible, ooh, just such a character. Whereas in the film he's just quite a nice bloke with some metal hands.
Hmm.
You know, very affable.
Yeah.
Quite cultured.
Knows how to treat some prisoner as well, because he just puts them up in a hotel.
Well, I mean, Dr. No in the book did that, but
he's
just a bit more creepy.
Yeah.
Like, originally he chains out Honey Rider to be eaten alive by crabs. Like, man-eating crabs.
Yeah, random. Could he not get any sharks with laser beams touch their heads?
No, they weren't at that point yet.
No.
Besides that, this is like Jamaica. Do they have sharks up there?
No, that I was just doing a stupid... It's like the crabs is just a step above ill-tempered manatees, whatever it was.
Ill-tempered sea bass.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. Ill-tempered sea bass.
Sea bass. We have sea bass. Are they ill-tempered? They're very ill-tempered. Okay.
Have to do.
But no, but that was a gaffe on his part, because it turns out that the crabs, Honey Rider was more familiar because she used to live in the wild.
Yeah.
So she's like, "Ha, he's a moron. They don't eat humans much. As long as you stay still, they don't eat you." So she just kind of laid there and wait till morning and stuff. But we're getting off the track and golfing.
Yeah.
I mean, even when I'm listening to this audiobook version of it, all I can see is Gert Frobe, who's probably in my top 10 actors, I reckon. Big German bloke, you know, just playing the big German bloke. If you think of big boisterous Germans, even Gert Frobe.
Yeah.
Of course, you know what other film Gert Frobe was in.
You're going to tell us.
This is what we call a link, because this is what's next on the agenda. Chick Chick Bang Bang?
Yeah. Also written by Ian Fleming.
And we watched it within the last 3 days or so.
Yeah, and we made the discovery that it was actually, the screenplay was actually written by Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl, yes. That was amazing, because it just clicked, because the original Chick Chick Bang Bang is literally a 10-page illustrated children's book. Doesn't have any depth to it. I'm not even sure half the characters are named.
No.
And yet it's been converted into... Well, I reckon... I reckon it's not actually recognised as being kind of as classic as Mary Poppins, which is weird, because I always considered it to be Mary Poppins 2.
Yeah.
Poppins harder. Poppins of a vengeance.
Yeah.
The Poppinsing.
Yeah.
And I came up the theory because it's like the Bioshock Infinite theory, in it, where there's more, you know, multiple universes and stuff.
Yeah.
That film could quite easily be a multiple universe of Mary Poppins, I reckon.
Yeah.
With Truly Scrumptious as Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And Bert's Cracks as Potts.
Yeah.
There wasn't really a villain in Mary Poppins. Well, Mr. Banks won it, so. There was no real Mr. Banks in that film.
No.
But yeah, I like Chick Chick Bang Bang. It's a good film, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of course, when you make the realisation that Roald Dahl did the screenplay, you kind of realise it's got his sticky fingers all over it, really, isn't it? because you've got these villains which absolutely hate children.
Yeah, Childcatcher definitely feels like a Roald Dahl cut.
It could have come creation. Straight out of one of his books, to be honest.
Yeah. Even some of the set design you were saying, because like big factory in the sweet shop, you're there.
It looks like Charlie's Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
You kind of expect Charlie to be Willy Wonka to be setting up down the road sort of thing, as one of the competitors.
Yeah.
And of course, my favourite theory is that Trudy Scrumptious was... I could be wrong. Maybe Ian Fleming did name her, but I reckon that was Roald Dahl kind of giving a middle finger to Ian Fleming's immature habit of naming ladies after...
Yeah.
Like Honey Rider and Pussy Galore.
Yeah.
Plenty O'Toole.
Yeah. Trudy Scrumptious.
Trudy Scrumptious, you know, something innocent and nice, but kind of the same Ian Fleming...
Yeah.
...touch, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you could make it dirty if you really, really wanted to.
Oh, no, don't go that way.
That's as far as I'm going to take it. I'm going to let the people at home have their imaginations go wild over what that could possibly mean.
Truly scrumptious.
I like how you tell me not to go that way and then you start doing it.
Yes, truly scrumptious. Bombs back.
Yep.
Yeah, I love that film. Of course, Gert Frobe's in it. Goldfinger himself is Baron von Volgaria or something. I don't know what his name is. Baron Bomburst.
Baron Bomburst.
Baron Bomburst, which is kind of. You can't get a name that evokes being a big kind of round bloke. And yeah, he's looking quite fit in that film. Yeah, he's not as big as he is in Goldfinger. He's quite a slim.
Yeah.
He feels big because of the performance he gives.
Yeah.
But he's actually. Quite slim.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm pretty sure it's his own voice in Chick Chick Bang Bang, because little known trivia fact about Goldfinger, Gert Frobe didn't know a word of English.
Yeah, so he had to be dubbed.
He had to be dubbed over by actor Michael Collins. And yeah, Michael Collins sounds like you'd expect Gert Frobe to sound like.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it was on purpose, but he seemed to do it with a slightly German inflection.
Yeah.
Even though Goldfinger's a British national.
Yeah.
Actually, I think in the book he was from somewhere else and he emigrated to the country, but he's considered a British national.
Yeah.
But, oh yes, a big German man speaks like this! And he's very memorable. And I feel really sorry for him at the end, because it's his wife who hates children.
Yeah.
The Baron quite clearly, he doesn't like children, but he quite clearly likes toys. He's a big man-child.
Yeah. Are you sure at the beginning he's there saying, "Oh yeah, I'm going to kill everyone, and you know I'm big and violent, blah blah blah." But then towards the end, after you see him that's kind of dancing with
the disguised dolls, because the heroes disguise themselves as dolls, don't they?
Yeah.
Oversized dolls. He starts dancing with them, and you're like, "Oh, he's not so bad after
all."
Yeah,
he's just enjoying himself.
And then the kids invade, and then they lock him up, and he's crying his eyes out. Oh, I hurt myself. My crown
is birthday.
Gone. And it's my birthday. And you're like, "Oh, I want to let him go. Yeah, he's not that bad."
Yeah, well, that talk at the beginning probably was just him trying to put on a show of saying, "Yeah, you should be afraid of me. You should do what I say."
Well, I think that's how he got to power. He was just like a mouthpiece, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm sure it was like a Macbeth situation where his wife was doing all the
plot. Yeah, she seems to be the smarter one.
Yeah. She's pretty much Lady Macbeth as well, isn't she?
Yeah, she's pretty much Lady Macbeth.
She was the woman from... Do you remember Casino Royale, the original? She was in that.
Yeah.
She ran the training facility.
Yeah, I remember her now.
With her little butler, Polo.
Yes.
Of course, any listeners don't have a clue what we're talking about.
Yeah, because there must be a host. I don't remember anyone in Casino Royale.
I'm talking about the
guy with
the
bleeding eye.
The original one that had six different directors. Pretty much every single main kind of actor of the era. So Peter Sellers, David Niven.
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen's in
it.
Jimmy Bond. James Bond's nephew.
Yeah.
My dad says I'm not allowed to have bullets in my body at any time. I think we should touch on that in a different podcast at some point.
Yeah.
I love that film so much.
Yeah, we showed that film to all of our mates and it just broke him.
I showed it to most of our friends.
Yeah, but Zaya definitely broke. He was always catatonic towards the end, saying, "What the hell?"
Okay, let's elaborate on Casino Royale, because it's kind of the only the flabby thing we can come back to.
Yeah.
Casino Royale came out around the same time as Thunderball, I want to say. It was... because I believe Casino Royale was sold to an American production company originally.
Yeah.
Because the very first James Bond thing was actually Jimmy Bond, CIA agent, and it was like a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah.
So some bloke still had the rights to Casino Royale,
yeah,
and he wanted to do a franchise thing. But he couldn't, and he realised that there was no way in hell he was going to get kind of the same series going, because Eon Productions owned the rights to James Bond.
Yeah.
So instead, he decided to make a wacky comedy out of it.
Yeah.
Satirising James Bond, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And he got all these actors on board, so we had David Niven, Peter Sellers. You name them of the era, they were in it, sort of thing. Mm. Even several actors from Bond films, so like the guy who plays Kronstein in From Russia with Love. I don't know the guy's name. Will would tell you.
Yeah.
My other friend, you know. The one who knows pretty much the second gaffer's name on every film or something.
Yeah.
You can list on every single actor in every film, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's just a mess. It's 3 hours long with about 5 different subplots.
Yeah, every single director had a different vision for the movie. So you've got the different German expressionism bit in the middle. Yeah. You've got crazy stuff going on at the end.
There's a random dance number halfway through the film.
Ah.
With like a scantily clad woman and like belly dancers and stuff. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
David Newman walks in and he's like, he just randomly goes to India to go find his daughter who's like, basically, it's implied James Bond had a fling with Mata Hari, and so there's Mata Bond, his illegitimate daughter.
Yeah.
So David Niven puts on his stereotypical explorer outfit, go find her.
Yeah.
And then there's this big dance number. There's a bit at the end where the very surreal kind of bass is exploding, and they randomly bump into Frankenstein, who I actually believe was played by Dave Prowse in that film. He was Darth Vader.
Yeah.
He just walks along, he's like, excuse me, do you know the way to the exit? And Frankenstein just walks into a wall, which turns out to be a door, like, thank you kindly, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's the opening, which is also a mess, with, there's about half an hour of Bond going to, because M gets blown up.
Yeah.
Within the first 10 minutes, so he goes to M's funeral, which is in Scotland, because apparently he's Scottish, and then there's this plot where all of M's daughters are actually assassins.
Yeah.
But it just drags on and on and on. There's a scene where they play Wussle, which is a weird game where you throw a stone ball to each other or something.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And even worse, Peter Sellers is in it and he's trying to play it straight.
That was one of the weirder bits of it.
The man who notoriously didn't have his own personality.
Yeah.
Trying to play a role straight. It's just terrible. He's like a walking piece of MDF or something. Mm-hmm. He should own every scene he's in because he's the man of a thousand voices and personalities and stuff.
Yeah.
And yet here he is, and he dies, you know, randomly.
Yeah.
Because he left the film or he was fired from the film.
Yeah.
Notoriously, it wasn't entirely sure which one it was.
Yeah.
Depends which source says what. Oh, what a mess. 3 hours long. And you have 3 hours of this film, which is much of nothing, really. And then the last 10 minutes is one big middle finger. I reckon the director who had to do that sequence saw what was coming for it and thought, got to give them something that's genuinely funny. So it turned into a slapstick comedy for the last 10 minutes.
Yep.
With a timer, because there's a dude who's taking a bomb and he's going to explode.
He's 125 times? He's got 125
times, so every time he hiccups, there's like one less. There's a little animated number that comes out of his hiccup.
Yeah.
And then you got what was it, a monkey in a toupee? The roulette wheel spins off, starts spitting bubbles out.
Yeah.
There's a flashing light in the banner press, which fires things. There's a random cameo from George Raft, who I believe was a gangster actor at the time.
Yeah.
Who's there, he was just at the bar, and he's like flipping a coin, and he just turns to the guy at the bar, and he's like, I've been framed. This gun shoots backwards. I just killed myself. And he just falls out like, this stereotypical Frenchman comes in, I believe he's a famous French actor, walks into Casino Royale's lobby, he goes up to the front desk and he's got his English to French dictionary and he starts reading, he manages to say, the French have arrived, and then all these stereotypical Frenchmen pile into the fray because everyone's having a fight.
Yeah.
And then there's, call the police, so cuts to a black and white thing of like with all the stereotypical bobbies piling into a car and driving off.
Yeah.
And then the reinforcements come, the Americans arrive, they're literally cowboys on horseback the Indians turn up afterwards. You get cowboys coming on the horseback into the casino.
Yeah.
And they've all got 007 painted on the side.
Yeah.
And then the Indians arrive via parachute, and they've got...
They're actually teepees.
Teepee parachutes. Isn't this not the greatest sequence ever put to film?
You can see why it would drive a man mad.
And like you've got the gangsters who are fighting the police, who are fighting the Indians, who are fighting the cowboys. The cowboys and the Indians start having a paintball fight.
Yeah.
And then everything explodes.
Yeah.
And then it just shows them up in heaven. And it's like, that's the end of the film. That's it. Done. And that's 3 hours of that, followed by 10 minutes of insanity, and then a really, really kind of twee number at the end.
Yep.
7 James Bond went to see the Royale and played it and so on, you know. It's just this really fucking... Oh, amazing. Oh, I love that film so much and I highly recommend it, even though it's 3 hours of... It's pretty much... Almost 3 hours of torture, but it's an experience.
It's definitely an experience.
It's an experience, and that's why it's in my top 10 films. It's probably in the top 5, because it's... Is it a good Bond film? No. It's terrible.
Definitely
is it a
my
good
favorite.
Film? Is it a good film? No, terrible.
Definitely my favourite Bond film, though, but then that...
Oh, that's saying a lot.
Yeah.
You like the remake
I like the remake of Casino Royale. I thought that was quite interesting. And I know, I liked Skyfall in the first viewing. I wasn't quite as into it in the second one, then the third one I started liking it again, so it's one of those... That's one of those...
You have a love-hate relationship.
Yeah.
It's but been that's... foisted upon you because you don't like Bond anyway. Yeah. Sorry,
I can kind of put up with the Roger Moore era because that feels a lot more tongue-in-cheek, but all the other stuff, I don't know, it's just... I don't know. Pierce Brosnan was the one I first saw a Bond movie of, and obviously I ruined that one Bond movie for you, but...
We don't talk about that.
No, we don't talk about that.
Except we will, because otherwise people are not going to understand. So one of my favourite films is Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in the Pierce Brosnan era.
Yeah.
I got into Bond around the time he was... GoldenEye had just come out. I think there was a 3-day Bond marathon. No, there was a 3-film Bond marathon on Sky Films. And I caught the first one and I loved it. And I watched the other two and I was like, oh wow, this is a really rich history sort of thing. It was like, I hadn't seen Doctor Who by then, so I didn't realise it was a thing where he had like, film franchises that go for years and years and years.
Yeah.
So I got to Bond and then Tomorrow Never Dies came out and that was kind of the first one that I don't think I saw it at the cinema. I think I caught it on video, but it came out and I was aware of it, really excited, you know, like the music. Love the villain in it. Jonathan Pryce chews the hell out of some scenery in that one. Played a really sarcastic kind of he's a media mogul. He's basically the baron of like media of the media in it. So you see him there as typewriter, and he's like making up the headlines. He's like, "You in America, what's the news?" And he's like, "Oh well, we've got our new software, sir, and we're going to release it full of bugs. This is your ass, so people will be forced to upgrade for years to come." You're like, "Oh, that's a nice jab at Microsoft there.
Yeah,
very well done. You know, very well thought out." And then the entire plot—it's insane. The entire plot is he's trying to set up World War III just so he can get the broadcasting rights in China.
Yeah.
This is how little of a fuck this guy gives. He's got so much power that he's just going to start a war, so he's got...
Broadcasting rights.
I mean, he's not even going to live for 100 years, but he's got... At least his empire's going to be, like, having the rights for the next 100 years sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there's one bit that ruined it for me, and that is right near the end, there's a sequence where, on his stealth boat, he's got this missile that's got razor sharp teeth on the front of it.
Yeah, so it can like burrow into the ground and
I think it's to
into submarines.
Into submarines
it?
Because he wants to make it look like submarine was rather than he can't blow up the submarine because he needs the nuclear missiles off of it. So rather ingeniously, they come out with this remote control torpedo with teeth on the front that can chew through.
Yeah,
so makes a perfectly round hole. It's like something out of an Acme kind of cartoon sort of.
But the point is, it sinks a submarine.
Sinks a submarine. Gets the job done.
Yeah.
So there's this thing strapped to the guide rail that they use to shoot out the thing. It's just hanging from the inside of the stealth ship.
Yeah, just in the hangar.
So there's a sequence where Bond gets held at gunpoint by Elliot Carver, the media mogul. And typically the villain's given his speech like...
Yeah. This is how I did it.
This is how I did it. And I'm going to have the broadcasting rights for the next 100 years, blah, blah, blah.
You can't stop me.
Bond, given all this spiel. So Bond manages to realise that the control panel for the missile, this torpedo with teeth...
Well, at least the crane that is on.
The crane that is on. It's next to his hand, so he rather surreptitiously manages to guide it so that it comes towards Elliot Carver.
Yeah.
Now, the point that ruined it is that...
They're inside an office at the time.
Yeah.
So there's a pane of glass separating them from the hangar. Elliot Carver's up against the glass, Bond's over by the control panel. The missile follows, is on a rail, it comes towards the glass, goes through the glass, and then Elliot Carver gets ripped apart. So we're watching this, and I say, hang on a minute, that thing's on a rail, it should stop just in front of the glass, just kind of whirring at them. It should, in order for it to go into the room, they would have had to have built the rail going into the office and put the glass around the rail.
Yeah. There's no OSHA standards in this stealth ship. Some bloke obviously cocked up the contracting on that. It was like, Bob, mate, you've built the rail going through the office. It's not supposed to do that.
It's supposed to stop, like, a metre in front of it.
Well, I've done it now. Oh, let's just put the glass around it and hope no one notices. But it just, ever since that bit, every time I see that sequence, I'm like, it's just, no.
No, it wouldn't work. It doesn't work.
It's ruined. And then this is the kind of thing where it's things that same in Spy Love Me. There's a sequence where Jaws is in a room and there's randomly a magnet on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And it made me think about that, because it's a room where I believe there's a shark tank under them.
Yeah.
There's no real need for there to be a big giant magnet.
No, but it's the shark tank. It's there.
So it's exactly the same thing again. It's like, why would they put that in that room?
And tie Jaws machine just in case you need it.
And then Roger Moore just does exactly the same thing, uses this giant magnet to pick Jaws up by his stainless steel teeth. And But yeah, waiting for a really good movie, Sally.
Yeah.
Well, we've really deviated. This was, I mean, it's Ian Fleming still.
Yeah, still Ian Fleming.
I can't remember if there's anything else we want to say about Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
No, we're mostly just talking about Roald Dahl's various influences on the movie, because there were quite a few. And
I think so. Now,
and the creepy children.
Oh yeah, the children are like straight out of a horror film. they keep saying things exactly at the same time.
Yeah, or finishing each other's sentences.
And yet I find them more charming than the ones in Mary Poppins.
I know, it's weird. But then I think the kids in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang have slightly more personality than the ones in Mary Poppins.
Well, they were more happy, weren't they? They weren't so cantankerous.
Well, the ones in Mary Poppins were supposed to be tearaways, but they're actually like the most polite tearaways you'd ever see. That they just seem to be a bit confused and go off and do random things and then get yelled at for it. But, like, we just wanted to fly a kite. We didn't mean to get lost for 5 hours.
In a chalk drawing? Or high on ecstasy, whatever it was they were giving them at the time.
Yeah.
That entire sequence, I think Bert just literally whipped out some sort of drug or something like cocaine or something like that.
Yeah.
Here you go, kids, have a sniff of this. It's a jolly holiday with Mary. I think we're going to watch Bedknobs and Broomsticks at some point, aren't we?
Yeah.
Because I consider that to be Mary Poppins 3.
Yeah.
I guess that would be Poppins Harder with a Vengeance, since that's
the
third Die Hard title.
Yes. Probably.
Something else I want to touch on. Trudy Scrumptious, we thought she was quite a strong female character.
Yeah, well, she was.
We play this little game now, don't we, where we try to find films with strong female characters in them.
Yeah.
Even though Trudy Scrumptious technically doesn't pass the... Do you want to explain what the Bechdel test is?
Okay,
I don't understand it. You explain, this is like the offside reward, like you keep explaining it to me.
The Bechdel test is a test to get people thinking about how girls are represented in media and storytelling and stuff. It's not a test to see if a movie passes as a feminist movie, it's just there to get you thinking. So a test is basically, is there more than one woman in the film, and they have to be named, do they talk to each other, and do they talk to each other about something other than a man? Which sounds like a really easy thing to pass, but...
The only one we can think of is probably Robocop, and even then I'm just thinking, I don't think she talks.
Robocop doesn't pass, but... Look, it's one of these weird things where stuff like Twilight passes, but most of your action movies wouldn't, like, The Avengers wouldn't, despite Black Widow being kind of awesome in it, Batman wouldn't pass, A couple of James Bond movies sort of pass, but at the same time, you most of the time when you've got like the villain, the female villain, and the female sidekick talking, they wind up going on about Bond, so that doesn't quite pass.
Well, but his name is in the title; it's very difficult to.
Well, the problem with most mainstream movies is you'd expect there to be like a lot of girls to be in it just for in background stuff, but most. movie representations, I think it's like 30% women, 70% men, rather than being more like real life where it's 50-50. So, and when you start going into actual named characters who are important to the plot, it suddenly drops about 1 to 5. So your chances are of getting two girls in the same room being able to talk to something plot relevant that isn't like, oh, how hunky and dreamy the main character is. And it's kind of, you're not very lucky in the past in most movies.
So it's more of a thought exercise.
Yeah.
But you still consider Robocop to be a good example of
her. Yeah, because Anne Lewis, she kicks some ass. She wasn't just a damsel for Robocop to save.
In
she actually
ways,
saves him.
Saves him at the end of the film because without her, he'd be outnumbered and outgunned, really.
Yeah, she was a pretty good shot. I mean, sure, she kind of disappeared for a while when Murphy was getting killed, but at the same time.
But bringing this back to Chick Chick Bang Bang, Trudy Scrumptious, we argued, would be because she's more level headed.
Yeah.
She's got direction in her life.
Yeah.
She's more responsible for the children rather than Caractacus Potts is.
Yeah, well, he just sets them run around wild when she says, well, why aren't they in school getting a proper education so that they can actually make something of themselves later on in life? So they're saying, oh, they're fine. Don't tell me how to raise my kids!
I mean, I was just a complete tangent here. I was sure it's really odd that Caractacus Potts is American. I guess it's because, did this film come out? It must have come out after Mary Poppins, because Dick Van Dyke's got a grey streak in his hair, hasn't he?
Yeah, a little
so
bit.
I guess he was told, don't do that fucking horrible accent.
Yeah. Well, I forget what the story is behind his accent, because obviously he was getting a language coach to teach him how to do a Cockney accent.
The
guy didn't know.
Bob Hoskins?
The guy had no idea how to do a Cockney.
Blimey, apples and pears.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Apparently the guy teaching him how to speak like a Londoner didn't know how to speak like a Londoner.
Yeah, it's probably some posh bloke who's just heard EastEnders a couple of times.
Yeah.
Right? Or what the equivalent was in the day, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, at least he doesn't have that terrible bloody accent, is it?
Yeah.
But it just seems a bit weird. But anyway, True Scrumptious here, strong character. And
yeah.
Good example. And it's a very nice film. It's very weird because it's from the people who did the James Bond films. It's a Cubby Broccoli production.
Yeah.
It's his team, and so you kind of get flashes of, like, as I mentioned, obviously, it's got, like, the aesthetic of the chocolate factory is very Willy Wonka, but at the same time, it could quite easily be a Bond lair.
Yeah, it could
be. Bond villain lair, you know.
Yeah, plus there's all the location shots as well. You were saying, well, any other place will just do this in a sound studio, but they're quite clearly on a beach on this.
Exactly, which is what they used to do with the early Bond films, is that they take it. If it's in Japan, they take them there.
Yeah.
Not Cornwall like they would in the Mon films.
Yeah.
Korea looks just like
Cornwall.
come for the sun and sand, stay for the oppression.
Yeah.
I highly recommend Chick Chick Bang Bang, definitely. Mm-hmm. My top 10 list has actually got about 30 films in it, so it's
yeah.
Good film. Have we got time? We've got, like, 10 minutes left. Did you want to touch on your films? Do you want to leave that till?
Well, okay, last Thursday I basically had a big film day, so I must have been in a chick flick mood or something, because I ended up watching Charlie's Angels, Coyote Ugly, and She's All That.
And the three films, the only one I've seen is Charlie's Angels, which I quite like.
Yeah.
But I presumably would be in the target audience.
Yeah, well...
ish.
Yeah, probably, actually, but... I don't know... She's All That is supposed to be one of the first teen comedies that came out, as you know, apparently everyone's supposed to have seen or something. So that was the first time me seeing it, and that was kind of an experience. Well, that it's basically a case of a couple. This jock who basically rules his school gets dumped by his girlfriend, who's like the queen bee of the school and also like a mega bitch. So he and his mate come up with a bet saying, well, anyone can be prom queen, so I'm just going to take a random nerdy girl and turn her into prom queen. So, yeah, it's that one.
Oh.
So, but of course, the nerdy girl he chooses, who's supposed to be all socially awkward and no one would ever want to touch her, is actually one of the prettiest girls in the movie. All she needs to do is take off her glasses and cut her hair. Suddenly she's perfect.
It's like The Mummy, where the lady in that's... a librarian, so she just takes her glasses off.
Well, that's what happens with all Hollywood movies, though, isn't it? It's a case of, oh, she's slightly nerdy because she's wearing glasses. Take it off. Oh my god, she's beautiful!
The Big Sleep. He even does it in The Big Sleep. Humphrey Bogart walks to a bookshop and there's a bookish lady there. And then just it starts raining and he's like, I got some time to spend. Do you want to have some whiskey? Yeah. And he's like, you'd look good with your glasses off and your hair down. So she just takes it down and then it's implied that they're just making out for the next hour.
Yeah. Yeah, so
that's a really old one, that. Chestnut.
So, yeah, that's an old, that's kind of a thing.
Watch how fast I go to watch that film.
Yeah, well, it's not really your kind of movie, because obviously it's a teen comedy.
It sounds a bit like the plot of Wicked.
Yeah, well...
Whenever I see someone less fortunate than the prom
queen. Well...
Let's face it, who isn't less fortunate than the prom queen?
Yeah, well...
My tender heart tends to start to bleed.
Yeah, are you going to do the whole
thing? Song.
In your cockney voice, randomly.
In your cockney voice. Well, I don't know what a talk sounds like. I can't do an American accent.
Yeah, well, it's just generic American accent, but... Yeah, so there's that, and... I don't want to touch on it too much, obviously you haven't seen it, so I can't really... go too far into it.
That's fine. What was the other one you saw?
Well, that's Coyote Ugly.
What's Coyote Ugly about?
Okay, so...
I know there's a song.
Everyone knows the song.
Which, for some reason in my head, is Black Velvet, but it isn't that.
No, it's... it's Can't Stop the Moonlight.
Can't Stop the
Yeah, anyway, Coyote Ugly is about this songwriter who starts off in a small town in Jersey, who decides that she wants to go make it big in... New York, actually starts to get a song sung on the radio and stuff, but she's afraid of actually performing her own songs. But so while she's trying to sell her music, she winds up getting a job at this
Yeah, minor interruption there.
Yeah.
Jigen and Willow took offence to Coyote Ugly. They didn't like you talking about it, so you're going to restart anyway, because...
I can't even remember where I was when the bird started...
Just off the top.
Yeah, so, okay, so Coyote Ugly is a movie about... It's a movie about a songwriter who lives in a small town out in Jersey who decides to go make it big in New York. So she started handing out her cassettes to music industry people who all like really bitchy back to her and all this, and they're basically saying that the only way you're going to get anyone interested in your songs is if you go sing live at a club and someone actually hears them. And of course the girl is gets stage fright, so she really doesn't like that idea. But so while she's trying to work out how she's going to make it into the industry, she winds up working in this bar out in New York somewhere, which is basically this really, really busy, popular bar where all the pretty bar staff dance on the bar. And
I was going to say it's Cheers, but it isn't.
No, they do make quite a few Cheers jokes anyway. In fact, there's a scene where the manager of the pub's trying to explain to some people at the bar what Coyote Ugly means, and of course it means it's basically when you've woken up after having this night out, you've gotten completely wasted, you look over and the guy lying next to you across your arm is the most ugliest piece of man you've ever seen, so you rather chew your own arm off than whisk rigging him up. So the girl she's explained this to just says, why would you name your bar after that? So she's like, well, Cheers was taken.
Boom, tish.
Yeah.
So that's what that film's about then. So what happens to her? Does she...
Well... She meets a man who at first is pretends to be a music guy. Yeah, it's shock horror. But he first pretends to be a guy whose foot in the industry could actually make it big. He's actually a fry cook in a bar, so she works this out pretty quickly and kind of makes a fool out of him. And then basically they start becoming good friends and stuff, and he tries to help her gain some confidence. And so, he doesn't play a massive role in helping her actually break into the industry, but there is this kind of, it's kind of, he's, doesn't get, trust people that well, because he's pretty much had to raise himself and all that, and everything, he works like five different jobs to sustain himself and all this, but he's pretty happy.
I can't say I'm thrilled.
No. Well, again, it's a chick flick. It's a chick flick.
So would you recommend Kaiju Ugly and She's All That?
I do enjoy Coyote Ugly. Again, it's not like an action movie. It's definitely a chick flick, but it's got some funny moments in it, and it's kind of an uplifting story, but it's still kind of a weird one because at the same time she gets over her phobia of crowds very quickly. They didn't really spend a lot of time on it, and every male person in her life is really against her kind of working in this bar, but then suddenly get over it after she's finally sung in front of some people and actually done her own songs and stuff. So, but yeah, I quite enjoyed it. And She's All That, it is actually pretty funny in places as well, but at the same time, that's also kind of weird because they kind of gloss over quite a lot of stuff.
Okay. You've really sold me on these two films.
Again, I'm rubbish at talking about stuff, but... Yeah.
But there's nothing in there that... So it's not really...
Yeah, it wouldn't appeal to a bloke like you, no.
Okay. It's
definitely...
Charlie's Angels, though.
Charlie's Angels, though, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, I can't actually remember the first one that much. I remember the sequel.
Oh.
Gyrating in a bar full of Russians, where barely anything.
Yeah. Well, the Charlie's Angels movies do really do seem like a thing of getting pretty girls to just dress up in random scenes, because...
But they're confident, Sammy, and sexually empowered.
Yeah, there's that, but at the same time, going through some of these scenes don't really make sense for them to be doing what they're doing, plus you have to kind of wonder if Charlie actually did any background checks at all on the people they're working for, because he's basically saying, oh, this guy stole some of our technology, we need you to get it back. So the girls go out, harass this business owner for a while, eventually steal what the client wanted them to steal, but instead of just giving it over to the client, they say, actually, we better do our background checks now, because we're not sure if you actually own this. So that's halfway through the movie.
That's the hazards of big time investigation firm, though. You're not supposed to ask questions. It's like the transporter, you don't ask questions about the package.
Yeah. But at the same time, these girls are supposed to be, well, they are basically private detectives for hire, or superheroes for hire, but if you're going to try and help someone, you should probably check beforehand if they're on the level.
You can't do that though with a business. If the client pays you to do something, you've got to do it.
Yeah, but then the client turns around and tries to kill them, so you think you should at least check to see if the client is who they say they are first, because they're using false identities and everything.
Yeah. And employing Crispin Glover or Crispin Freeman? Finn Man.
Oh.
Creepy Finn Man. He's yeah, Nightmare Creepy Fly's dad.
Yeah. I don't know his name.
Crispin something.
Yeah, creepy hair-smelling man.
That's all I remember from that film. Oh, and Bill Murray, randomly. Yes. Was he in the first one?
Yeah, he was in the first one. He was one of the better parts of the first one.
He was Bosley, wasn't he?
Yeah, half his scenes, you get the feeling he was just ab-libbing all the way through it.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So, of the three...
Charlie's Angels is the best, yeah, definitely.
That's what I was trying to get to here. Because I was like, okay, you got the other two, you're not really soaking on. In fact, you don't seem to kind of... You had a bit of trouble trying to remember them, so...
Okay, this was 2 weeks ago.
Whereas Charlie's Angels was like, oh, yeah, that's the one where they do stuff and the rest of it. So,
yeah.
Obviously, it left more of an impression.
Definitely left more of an impression.
Okay. Well, we've gone for an hour now.
Yeah.
It turned into pretty much the James Bond hour, which I think it tends to with discussions with me.
Yeah.
I'll try not to do
that. At least we didn't talk about Metal Gear this week.
Maybe next week.
Maybe next week.
I think we should just wrap up and plug some stuff.
Okay.
It's difficult at the moment because we kind of got about several things in the pipeline.
Yeah.
I hate being in the position where we've got the comic going out every week, so we've got two Doctor Dimensional Temporal World Tour still going on.
Yeah.
The next book's all lined up. I'm working on that currently.
Yeah.
For the next collaboration bit. But there's nothing I can really talk about yet because it's not got to that bit.
No.
So we're still working on stuff, but it's just not stuff we can talk about.
Yeah,
I've got a couple. I've got an art project I want to work on next weekend, because I've got a 3-day weekend.
Yeah.
Which will probably be up on the blog. I've got a blog post ready to go, but haven't got any images for it yet, so I'll sit down and do that at some point. You've got a blog post, which is ready to go, and obviously this podcast, we'll probably do it again in 2 weeks, because I think this is a better...
Yeah.
Gives us some time to find stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
or go off on tangents about stuff that we always talk about.
Yeah.
So. Anything else you would plug?
Unplug the birds, yeah.
Unplug the birds. No, not unplug.
All right, they're not robots, so you can't turn them on again afterwards. Well, I think we've still got some Wright Brothers we're slowly posting, but that's about it.
Oh, yeah, that's some comic that we're working on at the moment. So that's going up slowly and surely.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think just catch you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
Yep, go away.
Go away.